So for this evening session, we're going to continue looking in some more detail at the question of Buddhist ethics and what the Buddhist ethical precepts are and so on. And we're going to look at some details what's actually the content of these things. And as well as looking at some of the basic ethical precepts, I want to look at some of the suttas, some of the texts which were assigned in the reading, and for the discussion session which we're going to go later on, we're going to solve an ethical dilemma. Okay, so I'm going to assign you an ethical dilemma and you're going to solve it. Okay? Sound good? Okay, very good. Okay, so before we get on to the precepts as such, let's just have a look at a couple of the suttas. And here we'll look at the suttas that mention some of the things that we were talking about yesterday. This is a sutta just called the Akusala Sutta, and we don't have an English translation for this online. We only have... Can you read that? Well, you use in Pali, so if you can read it in Pali, anyway. Okay, so here we go. So this is what it says. Akusalang bhikkhave. So monks, abandon what is akusala. Pajahata means to, you should abandon it. Sakka bhikkhave akusalang pajahiton. So this is one of the ones I was referring to yesterday when I said the Buddha said it is possible, right? Sakka bhikkhave akusalang pajahiton. So you see, when I say these things, I'm not just making it up, alright? Sometimes it is actually there, right? If it was not possible to abandon what is akusala, then I would not say abandon what is unwholesome. But because it is possible to abandon what is unwholesome, that's why I say, please, you should abandon what is unwholesome. Akusala, what is unwholesome, if it is not because abandoned, then it is leads to the harm and suffering. Okay, somewhat there, it leads to. So it's a relative clause. So if it that's why I say that you should abandon it. That's why I say you should abandon it, because it leads to harm and suffering. Okay, when akusala is abandoned, then it leads to welfare and happiness. Okay, so this is a very basic statement on what's good, but it makes very clear a couple of those principles that I mentioned yesterday, that the Buddha's asking us to do something which is possible. And like everything in the Dhamma, then we have to ask, is that correct? Right? I mean, it's not obvious. And some people think that good and bad are kind of innate, right? That there's not much you can do about it. They think these things are kind of fixed. Right, but from what the Buddha said is that our minds can be trained, right? So sila is a training, and so it's something that we can learn to do better at, and so it is possible to do that. And also that very important point that what is akusala leads to suffering, abandoning what is akusala leads to benefit and to happiness. So that connection between ethics and psychology, how it makes you feel, how the mind responds to it. And this is what one of the points that's been made just in this very brief sutta. So even though it's a very simple sutta, then it's giving us some of those very important principles. So I'll just look at a couple of short suttas like that before going into look at more detail at the precepts. And here's another one which I thought was quite interesting. So as well as looking at some of the better known suttas in this course, we also have for the reading some fairly obscure ones, because sometimes there's a lot of interesting things that we find even in there, some of the suttas that nobody really reads or talks about. So this is a fairly obscure little sutta tucked away in the Anguttara Nikaya. A certain Brahman wanderer approached the Blessed One and said to him, Master Gotama, it is said, a directly visible Dhamma, a directly visible Dhamma. So this, when translation, directly visible, the Pali is sandittika, okay? Sandittiko, which is what we recite in the recollection of the Dhamma, when we do the recollection of the Triple Gem, and we go sandittiko, akaliko, and so on. So the word here, sandittiko, directly visible. In what way is the Dhamma directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable to be personally experienced by the wise? So the basic description of the Dhamma, what does this mean when we recite Sandiptiko, Akaliko, Ehipasiko, and so on? What does that mean? And the Buddha replies, Brahman, one excited by lust, overcome by lust with a mind obsessed by it, intends for his own affliction, for the affliction of others, or for the affliction of both, and he experiences mental suffering and dejection. But when lust is abandoned, he does not intend for his own affliction, for the affliction of others, or for the affliction of both, and he does not experience mental suffering and dejection. One excited by lust, overcome by lust with mind obsessed by it, engages in misconduct by body, speech, and mind. But when lust is abandoned, he does not engage in misconduct by body, speech, and mind. One excited by lust, overcome by lust, with mind obsessed by it, does not understand as it really is his own good, the good of others, or the good of both. But when lust is abandoned, he understands as it really is his own good, the good of others, and the good of both. It's in this way, Brahman, that the Dhamma is directly visible. And so on. And similar for somebody whose mind is overcome by hatred and delusion. And then the Brahma applauds the Buddha's statement and asks to be a lay follower, an upasaka, from that time onwards. So again, a very short and simple sutta, very typical of the texts we find in the Anguttara Nikaya. But again, it brings out a number of very important and basic principles for the understanding of Buddhist ethics. Again, we see the connection between ethics and psychology, right? The relationship between doing good and feeling happy, doing bad and feeling pain. But here we also bring in the question of the motivation, which again is something that we discussed yesterday. So the motivation here is in very general terms talked about lust, hatred and delusion, or greed, hatred and delusion. So when the mind is obsessed by these things, when you make choices based on these things, then it leads to the affliction of yourself, the affliction of others, and the affliction of both. Okay? Also a very important statement. We find this idiom very frequently in the early texts, and in fact is one of the major themes in many of the meditations taught by the Buddha, is to break down this boundary between self and other. It seems to have a bit of a ring in the microphone. Can we turn it down a little bit? Thanks. So, thank you. So, you know, sometimes there's this idea that you have a Theravada people in Theravada are only concerned about their own welfare, and Mahayana is concerned about the welfare of all beings, right? As if there can be this kind of distinction. I mean, it's a kind of meaningless distinction, to be honest. But we don't find that in the early suttas. In the early suttas, this is what's spoken very, very often. It's for your own good, for the good of others, and for the good of both. Yeah. And so ultimately, these distinctions they break down, right? What is it that's actually meaningful and useful, right, for yourself? How can you distinguish? I mean, we think in the short term, in a very limited perspective, that what's good for us might be different from what's good for somebody else. But the reality is, actually, we all live in the same world, and we're all improved when other people are happy, yeah? When other people are better off. The world is better for everyone. This distinction between self and other is not something which really ultimately stands up. So even though it sometimes seems that we might be practicing for our own benefit, actually we should always bear that in mind. Yeah? And each thing that we do, we should always reflect on that. And sometimes, you know, I reflect on it when I think, if I come and teach here, so I'm here talking to a group of people and trying to explain the Dhamma and so on like that, and I do that for my own welfare. I don't do that for your welfare. I do it for my own welfare because I'm overcoming my own selfishness and my own laziness, right? And all of those things that I overcome, and I clarify my understanding of Dhamma. And then when I go away into retreat and I meditate and I don't see anybody for months on end, I do that for your benefit, not for my benefit. Yeah, I do that to set an example, yeah, of practice and meditation. Yeah? So whatever we're doing, always think in that way. What we're doing is for one's own benefit, the benefit of others, and the benefit of both. And that is the basis of all Buddhist ethics. Yeah, his own good, the good of others, and the good of both. Okay. So there's a number of the basic concepts in Buddhist ethics mentioned here: greed, hatred, and delusion, and then the expression of that greed, hatred, and delusion by way of body, speech, and mind. Okay. So this is the that difference, or that distinction that we talked about yesterday, between the underlying motivation, which here is the greed, hatred, and delusion, is the underlying motivation, and then the choices to act out on that motivation through misconduct of body, speech, and mind. Okay? So this, again, and this answers that question very beautifully. So if we ask what is apparent about the Dhamma, when it says directly visible, immediate, and so on, actually, technically, what it really means is it's apparent in this very life. Okay, that means you don't have to wait to get reborn to see the results of it. And there's a number of different passages and so on that make that clear, that that's what's meant. And there's one passage where the Buddha is actually criticized, and somebody says, "You teach your disciples to abandon the good in this life for the sake of good in lives to come, for the sake of what pertains to lives to come." Right? That's actually something which is quite familiar in religious circles, isn't it? Right? We're not concerned with this life, we're only concerned with what happens next. Yeah? And the Buddha said, "On the contrary, I teach the abandoning of what pertains to future lives for the sake of what you experience in this life." Yeah, very, very interesting response that the Buddha made. Yeah, because even if whatever we're doing, if it pertains to going to heaven or something like that, it's still pertaining to future lives. What the Buddha taught: how to experience the Dhamma in this life. Yeah, how to experience the Dhamma in this life. This is what Sandhitika means. Okay, so that's a couple of brief suttas on some of the basic principles of the Dhamma. Any questions on that before we proceed?
Thank you, Bhante. I was just going to ask you about this last question of lust. Human beings, in fact, all creatures are born with this lust, and this lust is one of the main purposes of this lust is procreation. So here, the Buddha is advocating the abandoning of the lust. Mm. Okay, so how, first of all, how do you reconcile this natural lust that we have versus the abandonment of lust? Now, the second question is that some cultures, in fact, advocate polygamy and polyandry as an accepted kind of society. So again, does it mean that if I have more than one wife or more than one husband, mm-hmm. that is not abandoning lust? Even in Singapore here, Lee Kuan Yew himself at one time advocate one man should have more than one wife. And he actually mean it, you know, he wasn't just saying it as a joke, really.
Really?
Not so much for lust, but for both for procreation, really.
Need more Singaporeans, yes. Really.
So maybe you want to comment on this aspect.
Okay. Well, we're going to look more at the question of sexual ethics in just a minute. So maybe I might just defer this till then, if that's okay. But come back to your more general question. First of all, is that don't get misled by the translation here, and this is also something which is good to bear in mind as a general point. When we translate things from the Pali, then always there'll be something left behind, right? Something in the Pali which we lose, and we also pick up something new, right? So we pick up some new connotation. Now, in this case, the word that's being translated, I think, is probably raga. And it doesn't always mean sexual desire. When we translate it as lust, it basically means sexual desire, but actually it means any kind of desire or greed. Yeah? So it certainly includes sexual desire, but it's not exclusively that. So what's going to happen? Does that mean if we all practice the Dhamma that there's not going to be any procreation and the world's... Well, what's going to happen? The world's human beings are going to become extinct. This is a pressing and urgent problem that we'll need to address immediately. To address the coming crisis of everybody in the world stopping having sex because they're practicing Buddhism. I don't know. Countries that have been Buddhist for thousands of years seem to actually have no difficulty in keeping the next generation going. So we'll have a look at, again, this will come up more with the discussion of the Dasa Kusala Kammapada, the pathways of wholesome action. And what we see there is that the Buddha makes a distinction between like what's kind of, there's a word used sometimes in the suttas called visamalobha, which is, means basically excessive greed or excessive desire. So there's a difference between visamalobha, which is just excessive, and then just ordinary, yeah? So if you have ordinary desire, then that's alright, you know? But again, the thing is not to say that you can't do these things, right? It's not to say that desire is wrong or anything like that. It's just to say, if you have it, you will suffer. That's all. Right? So, just to understand that, right? If you want to go off and have one wife or two wives or three or one or two or three husbands or whatever, nothing's stopping you from doing that, but well, maybe the law is or whatever, but you just understand there's a lot of suffering, yeah? And yeah, I mean, sometimes people say these kinds of things, and to me, it's you know, people say, well, if everyone became a monk, then how would we, you know, how would humanity survive? And I'm like, yeah, it would be terrible. It's like if everybody became a hairdresser, then what? How would we survive? You know, there'd be so much hairspray in the air that the it's okay. Actually, I think it would be really good. I reckon it'd be great if everybody in the world spontaneously decided to become a monk or a nun. Imagine what would happen, right? So first of all, there'd be kind of big raid on all the cloth shops and the curtain shops and stuff like that. Everyone would be getting them and then dyeing them all orange and things and abandoning all the cities and going, and you'd go into the forest and everywhere you'd see there'd just be people sitting there meditating all over the place. Be fantastic, but of course nobody could, you know, grow any food or have a job or anything like that, so society would just fall apart. The novices would go raiding in the supermarkets, right? It'd be like a zombie apocalypse, except with monks instead. And and they'd go looting all, because no one would own the supermarkets, right? Because they'd all renounced it when they'd gone forth. So the novices would go and take all the food from the supermarkets, but it wouldn't be like kind of raiding it like they have in the, you know, violent zombie apocalypses or something. It'd all be very kind of polite. They'd say, please, you go first. No, you go first. And they'd say, oh, I just want to come and offer it to my Bhante. So they come and they'd offer all the food. And then all the food would be used out and you'd just meditate until everyone died. And the whole of the planet Earth would be full of skeletons with yellow cloth on them. Yeah? And then the aliens would come to visit and they'd see this and they'd say, wow, what sort of people were these? So I reckon it'd be really good. In fact, I think someone should make a movie out of it. I think it'd be great. The monk apocalypse, monkopolypse. Anyway, that's being a bit silly. So, so the main point here is that when we're talking in this context, we're talking about the coarser forms, the stronger forms of greed, hatred, and delusion, which actually prompt us to do unethical things. Yeah. Okay. So, let's have a look at the precepts, and of course you're basically familiar with most of these, but let's just have a look at what these are. So the first, so what we're going to be summarizing here is the Dasa Kusala Kama Patha, the 10 pathways of wholesome action. And we'll have a look at how these are described in the actual sutta in just a minute. But first of all, we'll just have a bit of a survey and I'll just describe generally what these mean. First set of precepts dealing with the body, right? So physical behavior. And remember what I mentioned yesterday, that you know, these precepts are very, they're not meant to be a complete description of everything that's right and wrong to do. It's a basic list of some of the very important things, okay? So the first one, not to kill. And so, of course, every religion and so on has this precept not to kill, but I think Buddhism is, and some others, maybe Jainism also has a very strong emphasis on not killing. But Buddhism is one of the few religions where that's very explicit and clear, and especially is not killing, where animals are included in that. And I think this is an extremely important part of Buddhist ethics. Yeah, that for all time, we've always taken it for granted that killing animals is something which is of ethical concern, and we should avoid. Not to steal. So this came up yesterday when we were discussing the parking coupons, right? And so, you know, I think probably most of the people in this room are not going to become like, you know, bank robbers or something like that. You're not going to sort of walk into the bank and hold them up and steal the money. But there's all kinds of opportunities to sort of, you know, work the system a little bit, you know, and maybe, you know, 5% here, 10% here, never mind, right? And so we're always kind of doing this. So these issues come up all the time. There are a lot of issues that come up regarding stealing and so on, which are quite new and quite different in our time compared to the Buddha's day. One of those issues which I've been involved in quite a lot when dealing with the Buddhist scriptures is the issue of copyright. Okay, copyright didn't exist in the Buddha's day, and so I mean they still had they kind of had an idea of intellectual property rights, because in the Vedic scriptures it says that if a lower caste person recites the Veda, you should pour molten copper down their throat. Yeah, so obviously they wanted to restrain people from infringing their copyright, I guess. It's a somewhat drastic measure. These days you usually politely ask people to stop, which are probably a little bit more civilised. So these days that's a big thing, isn't it? Intellectual property and so on. And often it's said to be theft, yeah? And from a Buddhist point of view, actually, it's not, right? So we have to distinguish between what's ethical and what's legal, right? So from a Buddhist point of view, theft is defined very clearly, and this is made very explicit in the Vinaya, that you actually have to deprive somebody of the ownership of something, right? So making a copy of something, you're not depriving anybody of the ownership of it, right? So making copies cannot be theft in the ethical sense in Buddhism. Again, that's not to say necessarily that it's the right thing to do, right? But it's to say, it's to try to understand what kind of thing it is. Yeah? So that these, often, you know, we do get these cases where things come up in the modern day and they do have situations which were not envisaged in the time of the Buddha. So sometimes we just have to do our best. Sometimes also there are things which are discussed in the time of the Buddha, but which maybe become much more complex at some later date. So, not to steal is another thing, to refrain from sexual misconduct. So this came up just now, and so in Buddhism the basic idea of the third precept is to refrain from sexual misconduct. Sexual misconduct is defined or described in a number of different ways in the suttas. But it essentially is any kind of sexual conduct that's going to cause harm, and primarily by betraying a partner. Right? In the suttas it gives a list of people who you shouldn't have intercourse with, people who are protected or under some kind of guardianship or something, so especially people who are underage or people who are married or betrothed and so on. So to come on to some of this, of course, there are many issues about this in the current day, which we have to address. And one thing which I think is very, very important for Buddhists to understand is that if we look around the world today, and it's something which for me is just an embarrassment in religion, is so many religions are just tearing themselves to bits because of their obsession with what other people are doing in their bedrooms. I mean, all of these religious people, maybe they feel that they're missing out. It seems like everyone else is having much more fun than they are or something like that, and they have to stop them from enjoying themselves, you know. I don't know what it is, but it seems to be this obsession, and religions are just tearing themselves to bits because of it. And one of the things which has happened again and again and again is that we've seen that the religious figures who have been the most heavy on these kinds of things, like the most anti-gay preachers in America, oh, it's an abomination, oh, it's terrible, blah, blah. Yeah, well, of course, then it turns out they're sneaking down for a bit on the side with some of the local blokes as well, right? And this has happened again and again. We've seen all the pedophilia scandals within the churches and these kinds of things. And this is what happens when you just become obsessed with these kinds of things. So from a Buddhist point of view, it's much more kind of open. The basic thing is, do you cause harm? Now, in the Buddha's day, we had, for example, the question was raised about polygamy and polyandry. Of course, that was normal in the Buddha's day, that people would have multiple wives and husbands and so on. No, multiple wives. I'll come back to polyandry in a moment. So that was quite common. Some traditions have it that the Buddha had three wives, although usually he's only said to have one. Certainly it was a kind of a normal thing to have multiple wives. And in most Buddhist cultures throughout history, that's also been the case. Certainly in Thailand, it still is. And, the Prince of Thailand has, I don't know how many wives he's got, quite a few. So it still happens, although it's kind of becoming less kind of popular in Thailand. But it's still there and it's still legal. and in quite a lot of other countries. Polyandry is rarer. In the Indian tradition, the only famous example of polyandry is in the Mahabharata, where the main story of that is a case of polyandry. But in Indian culture, it's not very common, although in fact India is so varied in culture that if you want to find a particular practice, you can find almost anything somewhere in India. But it was practiced, I believe, in Bhutan. I think Bhutan and maybe some other places, some more obscure places in Buddhist cultures, they actually did have a polyandry as a practice. So it has been in some Buddhist cultures. So again, from a Buddhist point of view, there's no kind of particular prescription that marriage must be of one particular form or something like that. And the precepts on sexual ethics never say that kind of thing. Now, this came up for us in Australia, and we discussed this in the Buddhist community quite a lot in the last years, because we had hearings on same-sex marriage and marriage equality and so on. And one of the things which I'd noticed when reading what they call the Dharma Shastras, Manusmriti, and the other Hindu Dharma Shastras, because of course in Buddhist texts it doesn't actually give any prescriptions about marriage, right? It seems to take for granted that Buddhists will just do the kind of marriage that people around them are doing in their society. So I thought, well, what kind of marriages do they have in India? So I looked in the Dharma Shastras to see, and they have a very interesting system of marriage. Because being Indians, right, everything has to be very, very complicated, okay? And they cannot just have one kind of marriage. That would be just too dull, right? So there's like a kind of marriage, you use the word loosely, for every kind of plane of the Indian cosmology, right? And so you have like the highest form of marriage, they call the Brahma wedding, okay? So the Brahma wedding is where you have a man and a woman who are both Brahmins, they're both pure bred, back seven lineages, and they have all of these kind of auspicious signs, and everything's kind of perfect. And when you have like the perfect marriage, then you have a Brahma wedding, right? And that's number one, right? And then you have like number two, and then it goes through the different levels of devas, so the kind of the different lower devas and devas. And when you can't fulfill some of those factors, then because of a lower level, until the lowest heavenly level is the Gandharvas, right? Gandharvas in Indian cosmology were kind of like nature spirits or something like that. They were guitar players, right? They used to sing out and dance and stuff like that, and they were kind of cool and stuff, but they weren't very much up there in the celestial hierarchy. They're just above the human realm, so that's like the lowest heavenly realm. And the Gandharva wedding is where a couple basically elope, right? They run off together. They don't have the blessing of their parents. They don't have a priest to officiate. They have nothing which we would normally consider to be necessary for a marriage, but they just run off and start living together. And that's considered to be a valid form of marriage, as long as the partners actually consent to the marriage. Yeah? And so then they have various other forms of marriage for the rakshasas, the demons and so on. So this is forced abduction and rape and these kinds of things. And so these are, of course, against the Dhamma. But all of those other ones are actually by Dhamma. They're considered to be good. And so to me, that when I saw that, I thought that was really wonderful, because that was a way of actually reflecting what goes on in human societies, right? Because the reality is that any human society, all kinds of different things happen, right? And you might think that you should do it one way or another way, but that's just your ideas. The reality is that all different kinds of people are doing different kinds of things, whether you like it or not. And it's interesting, when we had these hearings on same-sex marriage, that when we went along to them, they actually had a Senate inquiry, and I was one of the Buddhist representatives. They called for community representatives, so I went along and gave testimony on behalf of the Buddhist councils in Australia. And there were also, we had the Christians and the Jews and Hindus, Sikhs. At a particular hearing I went to, the Muslims didn't come, but I'm sure they gave testimony at other ones. But one of the interesting things was that both the Buddhist and the Hindu community supported same-sex marriage, as did the progressive Jews. And it was very interesting to hear the kinds of arguments that people used. And I discussed this with the Hindu priest who was there, and a Hindu representative. And I talked about the Indian marriage systems. And he agreed with what I'd said and said, yes, that's exactly how it is. In India, it's always been this kind of flexible approach. And around that time, there was actually a statement made by the Indian Attorney General, who made a comment on same-sex marriage, and he said that in India today, people often think that homosexuality is against Hinduism, right, and that that's an anti-Indian conduct. And he said that actually, if you look back in history, not very far, you see that the English used to come to India precisely because it was more open to different forms of sexuality than you could find in England, right? And that all of the gay English gentlemen used to visit India for their holidays, right? And it was because of that, and because it had such a reputation, that the English introduced the law, yeah, banning homosexual conduct, right? Which now the Indians say is their ancient tradition, yeah? And this is the kind of thing which we see a lot around the world, that we adopt things. We see this in the Buddhist tradition very often. And we often adopt these kind of Victorian ideologies and so on. We seem to have lost our signal here. So other interesting one was the Jews and the advocated in favour of same-sex marriage. We had the Christians there. I should just give a remark here that the Christians who were present was from the Anglican and the Catholic diocese in Sydney, both of which are notorious for being extremely conservative. The Anglican communion in Australia on the whole is actually very progressive, but the Sydney diocese is notoriously conservative, as is the Sydney Catholics. For some reason, it's a bit weird, right? But anyway, that's how it is. So both of those opposed, and they both had this very strong idea that there's one and only one form of marriage. And I was sitting here thinking, have you ever met a human being? I mean, honestly, no, there isn't one and only one form of marriage. There are many different forms that human relationships take. And this has always been the case, and it always will be. And they made an interesting thing because they quoted from the book of Genesis, and they said in the beginning, and it was Adam and Eve. And so because it was Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, therefore, you know, it has to be a man and a woman, right? That's the argument. I'm like, really? But then the Jews came up, and it's interesting in these interfaith things, right? Because the Jews tend to get a bit peeved by how the Christians use the Old Testament. Because the Christians sort of say, oh, this is part of their Bible, and they use it. But when it's convenient, they say, oh, just the Old Testament. It doesn't matter so much, right? The New Testament's the real thing, so they kind of dismiss it. But then when there's something there that they like, they kind of pick it up. So the Jews, you know, that's their scripture, right? So they get a bit... Anyway, so the Jewish person spoke up, and he said that actually in the Genesis, they weren't married at all. Right? Adam and Eve weren't married. Yeah. So if you want to take that literally, then the God's giving his blessing to, you know, living in sin. Yeah. So again, these are stories. You know, the way people live is much more flexible. And you know, when all of these things were spoken and all of these things were done, and I mentioned the one word that nobody else mentioned the whole thing, and that word was compassion. Right. And it was very interesting. And I said, where is the compassion? Right? Where is it? When we have people who are different, people who are suffering, people who have been persecuted, people who, you know, anybody who has a different form of sexuality suffers because of that, right? And that's not the other, right? That's us, okay? That's 10 or 20 or 30 people in this room. Okay, that's the person sitting next to you or the person next to them, right? Who has struggled about whether to come out, who has felt that they are weird and wrong and all of those things, and they've suffered because of that. And surely when people come to a spiritual place, they should find some acceptance, and they should find some caring and some understanding, and not just kind of more judgment and condemnation. And so it was very interesting when I mentioned this, then afterwards the press was there and stuff, and they all wanted to talk to me. They weren't interested in talking to any of the bishops and stuff like that, and they all came up and wanted me to talk about compassion because it was something which was so surprising and so rare for them to hear. Yeah? So always important to understand that with these things that we look at what's the reality, how it affects people's life. We seem to have lost our... Yeah. No, we got something. Sorry. I just did that a couple of times. So yeah. Okay. So in as well as these basic precepts, then in the suttas we mention a lot of other things mentioned from time to time. Some others mentioned drinking, which is not found in that list of basic precepts. So here in by the list of basic precepts, here I mean the Dasa Kusala Kamapata. So we find it in the five precepts, but not in the 10 pathways of wholesome action. So if you want to argue that there's a bit of wiggle room around the whole drinking thing, yeah, maybe. But it is very interesting, these things. You know, the Buddha said that, well, the basic reason for not drinking is because it makes you break all the other precepts. And if you look at the statistics today, that's exactly what happens, you know. I mean, it's a huge problem, you know, all of those precepts. So many things is caused by drinking. Unbelievable. Addiction to gambling is another one, which is also frowned upon in the suttas. Oh, very popular these days, right? I've never understood gambling. Yeah. Drinking I can understand, you know, but gambling, it's like you're just giving your money away to these people who already have more money than you. It's like, and it's supposed to be exciting or whatever. I don't want to just jump off a building or something. That's exciting. I don't understand. I only went to a casino once when I was a young guy, and my mum gave me like $10 or something to spend in the casino, and I went there and I changed it into chips and did one go on the pokies and my money disappeared, and I'm like, why am I giving my money away? I'll go and buy some beer instead. So that's what I did. So it was a very good investment. Okay. Okay, so the bodily precepts. Any questions on that before we go on?
At that time I was quite confused what to do.
He asked you to buy beer?
Yeah, he asked me to buy beer, but and I already explained to him that, okay, I don't drink beer, and there's a possibility that I will not buy it for you. So at that time I was like, I don't know what to do, and I just meditate and think about it, and I just decided not to buy him. And I told him what is the reason, because because even if you just drink a little bit or something, you just not really, you reduce some kind of your awareness in
Absolutely.
A way.
Yes. Yeah.
And then you are trying to escape from something, I told him. So at the end, I don't know what he was thinking. He might be insulted because of that, but I don't know. Is it the right thing to do? If you are trying to keep the precept, like not drinking and not kill something, but when the other person is asking you to buy the beer, you are not drinking yourself, but you buy it for the other person. How it relates to our precepts?
Remember, we looked at that earlier. It said, you know, do it for your own good, for the good of others, and for the good of everyone. Yeah. So in that kind of context, if someone asks you to do something which you're not comfortable with, the first thing you should do is just tell them that. You say, look, I'm not comfortable with this. Yeah. Most of the time, they should respect that. You know, they say, if somebody's trying to pressure you into doing something that you're not comfortable with, right, then generally speaking, that's a sign that maybe, you know, you should definitely stand your ground and not get involved with that. Yeah. Occasionally, of course, they might have a good reason for it, but generally speaking, if somebody's asking you to do something and you're not comfortable with it, then you should just tell them, look, I'm not comfortable with this. And then if they ask why, then you can explain why. But yeah, don't be ashamed to stand your ground. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, good on you. Yeah. Yes.
Bhante, what about if you can hold your alcohol very well?
Uh-huh.
I mean, you
after
can
after long practice.
So you can drink a lot, but you basically never get drunk. So that means that you won't lose your awareness, and then you won't break other precepts. So will that okay?
Is that a question or a confession? I'm not quite sure. For example, I don't know what the case is here in Singapore. Australia obviously is a big drinking country, right? And one of the biggest countries for drinking in the world, right? But we've gone through a massive cultural shift since I was growing up in the 1970s, and they've had a consistent public campaign about drink driving, and that's been very, very successful. And, I think it's been actually a very good model for how to create big shifts in culture. Two things Australia, I think, has done well. One is that one. The other one is the cigarettes and tobacco. And, there's a combination of tightening up the rules around it, right? But, see, the thing is that if you try to ban something completely, it never works, right? You just get a black market. So what they do is they gradually tighten up the rules, and at the same time you have a sort of consistent and very, very persistent public messaging and education. You know, and as a result of that, when I was growing up, like in the 70s and the early 80s, drinking and driving wasn't considered to be a big deal, right? I mean, my parents did it, right? They weren't wild characters or anything. They were school teachers and stuff, but it wasn't a big deal, right? And gradually, they began to introduce these laws, and it was like 0.8%, right? 0.08, right? So there you had this limit, 0.08. Now I think it's 0.02, right? They've taken, I think it's 0.02 now. That you can be busted for, which is basically if somebody next to you sniffs a glass of wine, you can get 0.02, right? And why do they do that? They did that because 0.02% makes a difference, and it actually affects your reaction time and actually affects the likelihood that you're going to have an accident on the road. And that's pretty much one glass of wine, right? It's 0.02. So even that much actually really does make a difference. So, yeah, of course, different people will be different in their responses to it, so fair enough. But still, it's a good idea to minimize or eliminate as much as possible. I mean, obviously there's a difference between, having an occasional glass of wine at an evening meal, right? It's not the worst thing in the world to do. But if then it's so easy to go down that slippery slope. So if you can avoid it completely, then that's good. But at the very least, have minimal and in moderation. Yeah. Yes.
It's a technical question as a follow-on to her question, and there seems to be some controversy among different groups of Buddhists on how to translate the Sura Maria Majapamadatana. Should it be translated as intoxicants that are the basis of heedlessness, or intoxicants which are the basis of heedlessness?
Sorry, what's the difference?
Okay, so the precept is only, in the first interpretation, the precept is only against drinking to excess. But in the second interpretation, when you use which instead of that, then they'll say it's an absolute training precept not to take any form of alcohol whatsoever.
I mean, practically, I think that question's been answered by the police. I mean, the police actually say if you have one glass of wine, it will affect your mindfulness. That's law. So there's no difference, right? Even one glass of wine will actually cause intoxication. Yeah. So you can't drink without getting intoxicated. It's just a matter of degree. Yeah.
What about morphine at the deathbed?
Uh-huh.
Would that be a problem if we decided to administer it to our dying parents?
Well, it depends how much they enjoy it, I guess. No, I'm only kidding. Pain relief is different, right? I mean, if you take medicines and pain relief, that's okay. That's not a problem. You're not taking it for that reason. So, again, you have to be reasonable for this. I mean, we know the difference between, a junkie shooting up and somebody who's suffering a great deal, and we're just trying to ease their pain. Yeah, so if your intention is just to ease pain or for some other medicinal use, and there are various drugs that have different medicinal uses, then I don't think we should make too much of a problem out of that. Okay, yes.
Ajahn, just want to understand a little bit. Just now you used the example that they actually discussed yesterday on the parking coupon, and then eventually you used a guideline where, for us to see, does it cause harm to another? So is that our guideline in a sense? Because ethical transgression is not
very clear cut, like kill, where it's just one point, but it's a range.
That's right. Yeah.
So when it is a range where it is gray area, so can our guiding to our understanding of the precepts, like, does, you know, to like not to steal, like example of the parking coupon, we use it in terms of whether it caused harm to another to be our definition, or it has to be really strict to the extent. Because, for example, just now they asked the questions about drinking. Well, you don't drink and drive. You absolutely observe that. But sometimes social drinking, once in a blue moon, so that does not cause harm to others. Is that an allowance to
it gives you a framework for assessing things, right? I don't think there's any such thing as an absolute moral rule in Buddhism, right? And Buddhism is not a religion of absolutism. It's a Buddhism of what's relative, right? Interrelation. So and everything ultimately is relative to suffering. So does something cause suffering or not? So if you're taking one drink, then that is affecting your mindfulness, and it is, in a sense, shrinking your consciousness. Okay? It shrinks your consciousness. That's what it does. So if it only does that to a very small degree, then it's only a small bit of harm. It's not such a big deal. Right? And if it does it to a bigger degree, then it's obviously more of a problem. So, you know, it's just up to yourself to make that decision. This parking thing is like really big, isn't it? I don't know. You can't see the harm. You know, I had a friend who I used to play music with when I was much younger, and he used to shoplift stuff, right? But he, of course, had an ethic about shoplifting, right? He would only steal from big corporations, and they're, like, really greedy and stuff like that. So it's all right, you know, if you steal from, like, Walmart or someone like that, because they're, like, an evil corporation. So, but then later on, he was, like, nicking from anywhere that he could, right? And even from, like, little shops that were run by people who were just working hard to get their things, and he'd still slip a little something in his pocket, yeah? So this is a problem. Yeah? So rather than, you know, in ethics, what kind of question do we want to be asking? Okay, is the question we want to be asking, what can we get away with? Right? In Burma, they have a saying: if you know the Vinaya, you can kill a chicken. Right? Yeah. So if you want to be able to get away with something, you can always find a way to justify it. Yeah. So rather than asking yourself that and spending your time thinking, can I justify it, ask yourself, what's the best thing that I could do? How could I be even better? Yeah. And then there's a number of different guidelines that we can use for that. One guideline would be, for example, how can this act be generalized? Okay. What I mean is that if everybody was to do this, actually, what would happen? And so, for example, with the parking coupons, right? Well, if everybody's dishonest, well, the government loses revenue. They've got to get the revenue somewhere, right? I mean, they've got to pay for hospitals and roads and stuff like that, yeah? So if they're not doing that, they've got to tax somewhere else in some other way. Now, maybe the taxation system isn't perfectly fair. No taxation system is. But on the other hand, you know, it's what we've got, so we kind of work with it, yeah? Or another question, the question of alcohol. You might think, well, I'm in control, I can do this. Maybe you are. Fine, yeah? But what about your children? What about the other person on the other side of the table who actually isn't in control? And they see you're drinking, and they're like, oh, yeah, well, never mind. And they take one, and then two, and then three, and then four, and then five, yeah? And, you know, big attitude with kids, you know. I mean, this is something I remember very clearly from when you're growing up. You know, you always have this attitude that parents always say, don't do drugs. Drugs are evil. Drugs are bad. Oh, my parents didn't say that. They weren't so thing. But you know, this message you get from society. Drugs are, but oh, yeah, beer is okay. Whiskey's okay. Alcohol's fine, right? It's completely hypocritical, right? And kids know that, right? It's completely hypocritical, actually. So if you're drinking and then you're telling your kids don't take drugs, yeah, well, good luck with that, yeah? Kids have extremely, you know, when teenagers, very, very refined hypocrisy meters, yeah? As very, very, and if they see these kinds of behaviours, they will know, right? So if you want to set a good example, don't do it, right? So the way to teach your kids, if you don't want your kids to take drugs, don't drink, right? Don't be trying to lecture your kids about what they should be doing. Just set a good example. And if you can be a good example to somebody who's happy and content and all of those things without having to drink, then that's the best way to stop your kids from taking drugs. Yeah?
Hello, Bande. I have an old dog. She looks like suffering to me. And then, because I know the precept, do not kill.
Yeah.
I actually told her, please die when you sleep. So you solve my problem. But my, the people that I know says,
okay.
But the people that I know says it's not human to let, you know, the old dog, you know, suffering live.
So what do you do?
I don't know. I keep telling her, you know.
Well, what if it was you? What would you want them to do to you?
Because the dog doesn't say anything to me. She just looks. she just looks in pain.
Of course, they say things to you. They say things to you all the time. Looks up at you with those big brown eyes. Oh. But what would, if that was you? What would you want?
I told my husband that if I like my dog, I just. Let me go.
You just want to be let go.
Yeah.
Most people is like that. It's very funny. We have this reluctance in society. Actually, if you ask most people, they would prefer not to be kept alive if they're in that situation. And yet, you know, this is like the golden rule. Do unto others as you'd have others do unto you. Right? That's what it means. Yeah. Actually, if that's what you'd prefer not to do, then maybe that's what you should be doing with your dog as well. Huh? So, like I said, none of these precepts are absolute. Okay, and that's a difficult question, and it's one where there are no black and white answers. Right? This is both black and white karma, remember I talked about yesterday. So on the one hand, you want to alleviate suffering, and that's good, that's compassionate. On the other hand, you're wanting to end a life. Yeah? So that's not good. So it's both black and white. There comes a point where I think anybody would say, you know, death is preferable, right? Where that point is, you can't say 100%, yeah? But what you can say is that if you do decide to euthanize your dog or your mum, right? I mean, it happens, right? This is going on, it happens in hospitals every day, right? And, you know, so be very clear about what your intention is, and to be very clear that your purpose is to alleviate suffering. It's out of compassion, yeah? So in Buddhism, you know, one of the heinous crimes is to kill your parents, right? And so people are sometimes very concerned about that. But that's not what that means, okay? What it's talking about is murder, right? I mean, there's a big difference from thinking, oh, I want to kill my dad, right, and going off and slitting his throat, right, and then thinking your poor old dad is there suffering from cancer and is just, you know, lying in agony every day, stuffed full of painkillers and completely unaware, and we're going to prop him up on life support. That's not what the Buddha was talking about when he talked about that, okay? So we have to just use our common sense with these things. If our motivation is to alleviate suffering, okay, then again, it's not entirely clear. There isn't a black and white answer, and that's what life is. Right? So we just have to make a decision anyway. So if you do go ahead and make that decision, make sure you have compassion in your mind, you know, and do it clearly thinking of the welfare, and always use that as a good criterion. What would I want to do if it was me? What would I want people to do? I let me go. Right, that's what I say. Okay, if it ever comes to it, right. Come in the morning to offer dana, and then like Sujata, where is he? Oh, he's had a heart attack. He's lying on the thing. He's comatose. Please let me go. I have a organ donor card in my thing. So, yeah. Sorry? Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Uh,
Ajahn, if by not doing something and somebody gets killed, is that breaking a precept?
Okay.
You could have done something.
So that's another, I mean, this is a classic distinction that's made in ethical philosophy, the distinction between acting and failing to act. Okay. And typically, we understand that if somebody dies, if we fail to act, it's not as heinous as if we actually do something. So the classic example is if you're walking along the beach and you see somebody drowning and you don't go in and save them, okay? Well, that's probably not a good thing to do, but it's not as bad as pushing them in the water in the first place. Yeah? Yeah? So, I think there is something to that. But it's a complicated thing, and it really depends on the circumstances, right? I mean, if you take that to the logical conclusion, you think, well, what about how many people's lives could I save by giving money to poor people, right? I mean, you can probably, like a dollar would probably be enough to save someone's life in Africa or India or something like that. So how can we justify spending an extra dollar on anything ever, right? I mean, this is a very powerful ethical question, and I think something that we really need to think of seriously. Yeah, actually, how can we justify all of these things? Yeah, when time comes to buy a new car, or to get a new home, or to do any of these things, actually, $1,000 I'm spending on this thing. You know, we did a fundraiser in Perth some time ago. We raised some money for a medical center in Bodh Gaya. If you go to the Root Institute, you see they've got a medical building there. $10,000. That's all it took. Yeah, to build a whole building that they can actually treat people in. Yeah, and so really, we need to deeply question, this thing, not acting. Yeah, by not acting, we allow so much suffering to take place. Yeah, but on the other hand, we can never stop everything, right? There's a wonderful story from the Chinese Buddhist story. Where one day the man went down to the beach and these tortoises had stranded themselves on the beach, thousands of them. And a man was walking along and picking the tortoises up and putting them back in the water. And the man came along and said, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm saving the tortoises. He said, but look, there's thousands of them. You can't save them all. What are you doing? He says, well, I know I can't save them all, but I can save this one. Yeah? Okay.
Banti, I have a question.
Yes, where are we? Oh, we're here. Oh.
There are companies who work the law, like what you say, work the law. Like, for example, they may register their company in a certain place,
and they
have their management decision made in another place,
right.
And end up they do not, because of that, they do not pay any taxes.
Right, yeah.
I shan't mention the names of some of these companies. But my question is, what if you are in a line, say a tax expert, and you constantly got to work your mind to help the company not to pay tax?
Yeah.
What is your opinion about undertaking such a livelihood?
Yeah.
As a tax expert or?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd say that's from livelihood. You're that's like Dhananjani was the corrupt tax collector in the time of the Buddha. But basically, I think that's wrong livelihood. Companies should pay taxes, and they wriggle out of these things either by breaking the law or by bending the law to their needs. Sometimes they do it by actually changing the laws for their own benefit, and it's huge amounts of money, which goes to people who really don't need it. And away from the pockets of all the other people who need it. And the people who work hard every day, the tradespeople and the people who are earning wages and so on, and they all pay their taxes. And there was a very interesting anecdote that came out a couple of years ago where Warren Buffett walked into his offices and asked everybody, how much tax rates are you paying? And they all said how much taxes they were paying, and he said, I'm paying less tax than any of you. Yeah? And he's not... he's kind of well known as a businessman with integrity. He's not sort of aggressively ripping off the system, but the system's just being bent to favour. Yeah? So definitely I think that if you're part of that you should try to, the livelihood of doing taxes is not wrong livelihood as such, right? But it can be used in that way. And I think definitely you should, if somebody's doing that, they should try to see if they can find maybe a different job or a different way of doing their job, that so that they're not helping to justify companies ripping people off in that way. Yeah.
Oh, hi, Bhante. Hi.
Where are we? Oh, where are we? Yes.
Hello.
So there's this precept of not killing or harming any living beings, right?
Hmm.
My question is regarding in scientific research, right? Most of the time we need to like maybe purposely injure guinea pigs or something.
Okay.
And then we try our drugs on it. And most of the time you probably need to kill them as well. Any comments on that? Like, is there a way?
It's terrible.
Yeah. What's the Buddhist view on this?
Buddhist view is we should stop it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, those drugs and those tests. You said, you know, sometimes animals might die and things like that. Well, you have to understand that basic testing procedures. Most basic test is used in animal testing is called the LD50 test, which means that lethal dose 50%. Okay, so that means that of the animals which are being tested, half of them have to die in order for the test to succeed. That means even if you're testing them on water, you have to stuff water into them until half the animals die. And the other half, of course, will suffer greatly and almost die, right? But they don't quite die. And that's a standard test which is used on everything from cosmetics to dishwashing liquid to, you know, pretty much anything you can imagine. Eh? And the other test they call the Dreyes test is where they get it and they put it in the eyes of rabbits. You know, they put rabbits in cages, open their eyes forcefully, and then drip chemicals into their eyes to see what happens. I mean, these things are absolutely hideous. And I think one of the problems is that people always talk about medical research, but the bulk of animal experimentation happens on things that are completely stupid, like cosmetics and floor wax and things like that, and there's absolutely no need for animal testing and those kinds of things. Huh? And really, that's just a purely profit-driven thing. You know, if there's a problem about the safety of things, we've got enough floor wax. Frankly, we don't need better floor wax. Who cares, right? We don't need all of those things. So the vast bulk of those kinds of testing, I think, should just be stopped outright. In the case of medical testing, there is a variance of opinion about how and to how effective it is, and to what is the point of doing those things. I certainly think that we should, at the very least, we should proactively pursue other forms of testing. And we're in a good situation today where a lot of tests can now be done by computer modelling and also can be done by stem cells. So these are two new technologies which are actually making a lot of former animal testing either irrelevant or at least can reduce the amount of animal testing that's done. So in the case of genuine medical research for serious medical conditions, okay, then, I mean, I'd still prefer to see no animal testing at all, personally, but I can understand that there's a justification for it. But that's only a small minority. Even among the medical research, I think I mentioned yesterday, I actually sat on the ethics committee for the Royal North Shore Hospital, you know, and most of the proposals for medical research are actually things that are not that essential, you know. And so, you know, so many drugs are in development and so on and so forth, and so few actually come to market. So I think that there's a huge scope to reduce the number. But there has been some progress in that, especially in the area of chimpanzees and primates. And so there seems to be a strong movement towards phasing out using primates for animal research, which I think is fantastic. I don't know if you've seen the pictures. You can see it on YouTube. There's some amazing videos of what happens when they've had laboratory chimpanzees and they're released out into the open for the first time. Has anyone seen those videos? Just amazing. They just come out of this room and they're just being kind of released, and they're like, there's like four or five of them, and they're gathered around the doorway and they're just too scared to come out. They've never seen outside before. They've never seen the sky before. And they're looking outside and coming back and looking at. And then one of them sort of tentatively steps out into the yard and sort of looks around and then scurries back, and then the one comes out. And then when they realize they can actually go, my God, the joy they have is just amazing. They're just running around and leaping and playing. And there's just, you, for the first time, you know. And you see, these are such beautiful creatures, you know. And to put them in that place and treat them like that is just a terrible thing. Yeah. Oh, and just another thing, just another point on that, and the animal research thing is that people always justify, oh, because we need to treat X, Y, Z, right? But actually, if you look at the cost-benefit of things, right, almost always the actual way to treat things is by prevention, right? And actually, that can prevent much more disease than developing all of these new expensive drugs, yeah? The other thing is that even if you look at treatment of drugs, right, what are the things that actually cause suffering? Well, malaria, yeah, pretty much number one, right? But who cares, frankly? It's only poor people who get malaria, right? So if people are actually concerned about helping people through medicine, you don't need medical research, right? Actually, you need to buy mosquito nets and mosquito repellent, and that is going to save a lot more lives for a lot less money than doing all of this expensive research, which is ultimately, you know, almost all of that research, if you see what actually happens, it's actually to look at very rare diseases that rich people have, because rich people can afford to pay for the drugs.
I like to ask one question. When I see animals kept in small enclosure, I felt very upset, and my brother has been keeping this tortoise for many years, and it's a very small confined area. I find that it's hard to tell him because he said it's my pet. And my mom allows him to do that, and then the water is always get very dirty. I just feel very painful to look at it. What can I do?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, tortoises aren't chimps, right? I mean, a tortoise has a fairly low kind of requirements for entertainment, right? So I don't imagine it takes, you know, I mean, keeping animals in captivity isn't necessarily always a bad thing, right? For example, they're not going to be eaten, right? They don't have to be afraid of predators, and they get a regular supply of food. I mean, that's important things, right? That's basic survival, right? Which a lot of animals in the wild don't have. So, you know, even though, yes, it might not be ideal, but living in the wild also sometimes isn't ideal. So definitely, if you are going to keep animals in captivity, then sure, you give them a good amount of space and keep them well and so on. But I don't think that keeping animals in captivity is per se necessarily more harmful than being in the wild. But it depends on the cases. Yeah, tortoises, well, how do you tell if a tortoise is happy or not?
I look at it, but I mean, I feel better now because every time I look at it, oh, so it used to be very small, but now it's really big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe just, you know, see if you can get a bigger enclosure and make sure it's kept clean and those kinds of things. Yeah.
Okay, I think that I can tell him.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. All right. We're not getting on to the next bits, but that's fine. Good. Keep the questions coming. They're good.
I have a question on the third precept.
Yes.
And this relates to young people, and particularly for the girls.
Uh-huh.
Because I think the sutras talks about protection for females,
right,
specifically. And in that sense, you know, it targets at the men against the women. But in modern age, and particularly right now, more and more girls are having underage sex. Okay, and recently I met a young girl who's just 14, and she's now filled with a lot of guilt that she's broken the third precept.
Okay.
So I don't know what does the sutras actually say to try to counsel her.
Well, did she break that precept?
Well, it's underage sex.
Yeah, so this is the question, yes. Yeah, so does that mean that it's breaking the precept?
Is it?
Probably yes, because that's how it's kind of defined in the suttas, is basically if there's a kind of a legal or a social norm that this person is not the kind of person that should be, you know, should be having sex with, then that's what counts. So I would say yes, that probably does count, yeah.
So what if these are two teenagers?
Yes, two teenagers. Well, it's complicated, isn't it? I mean, that thing you made before, you know, you said, well, people having more you know, these things happening more and more. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I've looked at various statistics and things like that. I mean, basically, these things have always been going on. I mean, in the suttas, it's considered normal to get married at 16, right? And so, you know, these days we would think that's very, you know, way too young. I have some of my students in Sydney. I have a very interesting episode with them, and they're from South America. And she came along one day, and I was talking, and she was crying. Now you might think that if you're from Singapore, you think that somebody crying like that is a big deal because Singapore people don't have any emotions, right? But in South America, they've got lots of emotions, right? Maybe they exported them all from Singapore or something. I don't know, but they just cry all the time, so it wasn't such a big deal. But what happened was that it was her son's 14th birthday, right? And she told me the story, and she said she hasn't really told anybody the story before. And she said that when she was 14, right, she ran away with her boyfriend and they got married. Yeah, they were living in South America in a Catholic country. 14 years old, they ran away from home together, right, got married, yeah, came home after the weekend and said, hey, Mum and Dad, we're married. Right? And they're still married. Yeah, they're happily married, and they love each other to bits. And have had a wonderful life, yeah. But then, when their son, then turned 14, right? It just brought these things up again, you know. And she could realize the pain and so on that the parents must have been feeling. So it's why it's just to remember that when these things happen, that it's very difficult to judge, right? It's very difficult to say in a particular case. Obviously, you know, for a 14-year-old to be having sex is probably not a good idea, right? And so, you know, you need to sort of be with them. But don't be kind of judging them and so on. It's quite normal. And kids mess around, and teenagers mess around, and they stuff up, and it's very normal. So you don't, you know, say, you know, don't want to try to justify it or apologize for it. But don't judge them and condemn them. Yeah? She obviously knows that she's done something wrong, you know, and that's why she's talking to you about it. So in that kind of case, right, if somebody actually knows that already, I'm not worried. Right? If somebody came to me like that, I wouldn't be worried because they know what's right and wrong. Yeah, it's the people who aren't coming to see you that are the problem. Yeah. So once somebody has actually had enough self-awareness and enough honesty to come and share it with you, they've already done the hard work. Right? So then just at that point, you just give them a bit of support and compassion, and they'll be okay. They'll work it out in the future. Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it too much. But a lot of these things also, it's important to recognize that these things are, often there's a lot more fear about them than the reality. There was an interesting survey that came out just last week, and they did a survey on reality versus perception in countries around the world. And this was one of them, was about, I think, teenage pregnancy. They said, you know, how many teenage girls get pregnant? And then people said it's like 25% or something like that. And in fact, it's like 0.5% or something. Yeah? So people have a lot of fear about these things. But there was another very interesting survey that came out about 4 or 5 years ago now. And this was a large meta-survey of studies on ethical or moral incidents or breaking various moral principles in different countries, in different regions, and they looked at religious areas versus non-religious areas, okay? So this was done mostly in the Christian world. They didn't look at Buddhist countries. So, for example, comparing very religious areas in Europe, say Greece and Spain and so on, with much more secularized areas like Norway or something like that, and similar in America. Yeah, there's kind of more secularized states in the north with the more religious states in the south. And they compared these things on a wide range of the normal kinds of things that religious people regard as being moral issues, like, say, abortions, teenage pregnancy, drug use, so on and so forth. And they found that consistently the incidence of all of those things was less in the secularized states and secularized regions than it was in the religious regions. Okay? Yeah? And that was a very, very, very kind of robust finding. Yeah? And of course that leaves open in the interpretation of why that's the case, right? And it seems likely that the main reason was education, Right? So in the secularized areas, they tend to take an approach of educating children about issues rather than saying, don't do it. Right? So like in the south of America, they have these kind of virginity programs, right? So you have to say, oh, I'm not going to have sex before I'm married, and you have these things. And of course, it's a complete waste of time, right? You know, whereas in the more secularized areas, they educate kids about things and they teach them, well, these are the consequences. This is what can happen, and you can get pregnant, and this is, you can get STDs and so on and so forth. And that's how kids actually learn, right? Not by being told what to do, but by having a chance to discuss it and to consider and reflect on consequences. And that's how you sort of learn to have a more mature morality. So with all of these things, you know, don't fall into the trap of being sort of scared by it and think it's a big problem. Actually, it's just normal human behavior. And if you can't mess up when you're a teenager, when can you mess up? I mean, come on, right? Right? It's okay, they mess up, you know, they'll learn.
Man is not sure.
Sorry? That's the message I'll be giving to the youth group on Saturday. I'll say, go out, mess up now while you can. Yeah, then you won't be able to.
Actually, I'm going to censor your talk.
Attached to gambling and not attached to drinking, that the word addiction to.
I mentioned that because it only comes up a few times in the suttas, and when it does come up, it actually does say addiction. It says akiduto, which means literally addiction to gambling. So the suttas of the early texts, I think, are a bit ambiguous on the question of whether gambling as such is something that should be done. I don't think it's certainly something that's looked on as favourably, but I don't think necessarily that doing a little bit of gambling is necessarily against the precepts. Yeah.
I think that gambling is okay if it's not eviction. Because drinking is definitely not okay, even though it's not eviction, but gambling is okay.
There's maybe a little bit of wiggle room there. Yeah.
Thank you.
Having said which, you know, I mentioned before that, like, in Australia we drink a lot, and alcohol is a huge social problem. Gambling is a bigger social problem. Gambling causes more social harm in Australia than drinking does. Yeah?
Hello.
When I went to Sri Lanka earlier in the year, they were all talking about how the now what's the name? The Australians are now building a casino in Sri Lanka. Right? So, yeah, terrific. Yeah. Anyway. Hello.
Bante. So what if we do stock investment, and let's say, for example, Lockheed Martin or Las Vegas Sands, is that against the precepts?
Sorry, I didn't...
If we invest in stocks, right?
Yeah.
Of, let's say, defense companies or gambling companies like Las Vegas Sands.
Yeah.
So should we actually buy those stocks?
No. No, definitely not. Yeah. So this is like something which is really important, and thank you for asking that question. So there's a big movement now for, they're called divestment, right? Which is, or ethical investment. So you put your money in those things that are good, and you know, I think this is something that everybody should consider. You know, and there's much more that's available these days in terms of ethical investment options, and you should. You know, if you have any money at all, you should go to the bank and ask them about it, right? Banks will develop ethical investment portfolios if there is demand for it, okay? And if people start asking them, they will start developing these things, yeah? And there will be different banks offering different options. This has come up a lot recently with climate change, right, and the big movement to divestment from companies in fossil fuels. Yeah, and you can see that this has a huge impact, right? And this is one of the most effective instruments of social change if you want to try to do something good, is divestment. We had we did an interfaith delegation to Canberra last year, and as part of that we had a talk by an economist from Oxford who happened to be visiting Australia at the time, and he talked about divestment and he talked about why it was so effective, right? And it was quite interesting. He said the reason why divestment is very effective is because when people invest money, right, it's all on margins, right? So you know, you might think I'm going to make 7% if I invest in these stocks, and I might make 6% if I invest in those stocks, right? So you don't actually have to take all the money out of one set of stocks in order to make it unprofitable. You just have to shift it from being 7% to being 5%, right? So that it's less profitable than the other one. And that already makes it a better choice. And so if you can do that, then people will shift their money. But it's even more than that. You don't actually have to change the return. You have to create the fear that there might be a change in the return, right? And that is enough for people to start taking their money out of it and putting it into something else which is going to be ethical. And that's a huge driver of change, and we see that big influence. It's happening in a huge way in Australia right now. There's a proposal for a coal port that's going to be on the Great Barrier Reef. They're building one of the world's biggest coal mines. You know, billions of tons of coals they want to dig up and sell to India. It's an Indian company that's developing it, right? And as well as the ordinary implications of developing and selling and burning more coal, right, there's also the problem that it's at the Great Barrier Reef, one of the world's great natural wonders. And so it's going to have a huge environmental impact there. And, of course, our current government's trying to pretend that it's not going to have an environmental impact. But everybody knows it will. And there's been a lot of protest about it. And what we've seen with that particular one is that Citibank and Deutsche Bank and all of these huge, big international banks have all withdrawn from that project. Yeah, one by one, they've pulled back from that project because of the popular opposition to it. Yeah, and so it's not enough. You know, you don't have to actually stop it, but you have to create enough fear. Right? And so that's made a huge difference. And it's now got to the point where I just saw in the paper the other day, now the Queensland government is actually talking about funding it themselves. Right, they're going to actually bankroll this Indian company themselves because they couldn't get the banks to do it. Yeah, and so this actually, where you put your money is actually very important, and it's one of the most significant ethical decisions that we'll make. Right, especially if you've got any substantial money. I mean, if you're just a poor struggling student, it doesn't matter too much. So it's something to think about. It's certainly something for the BF to think about, and I certainly encourage the committee here, if you haven't already, to put that on your agenda and to say the BF money should be invested in ethical investments. And this is something which has taken a lot. It's really taken off in the religious sphere. Last year, the Uniting Church in Sydney had a meeting, a long meeting, where they eventually decided unanimously to completely divest from fossil fuels in New South Wales. So that's the whole of the Uniting Church in New South Wales has made that decision. And that's a very, very forward-reaching decision. It received a lot of publicity, and it was a wonderful thing to see them doing. A lot of other groups are doing it as well. Stanford University is now divesting from fossil fuels. ANU in Australia is also thinking of divesting. Even the Rockefellers are divesting from fossil fuels, right? The Rockefellers, right? These are the guys who invented oil, right? They are now divesting from fossil fuels. Yeah. So definitely is something that as Buddhists we should be thinking about. And we might think, well, you know, BF doesn't have enough money to make any difference. So, but by doing it, it's not the matter of how much money you have, but it's a matter of setting an example. And when people see that you're doing it, then there'll be a big flow-on effect, and it can really change things. Yeah. So we're really hoping in Australia, we're hoping that this terrible development on the Gold Coast, in the Queensland coast, is not going to happen. Hoping that we can save the Great Barrier Reef, and if that happens, it will be because of divestment. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Good. Oh, these are all very good questions. A really good conversation tonight. So, but we haven't got on to the other things. Wrong speech. Don't do wrong speech, okay? Done. Calvin and Hobbes. Sorry, too blurry? I can't blow anything up. Can you read it? Yes, Calvin, Miss Wormwood, I'm a fierce advocate of the separation of church and state. Nevertheless, says Calvin, I feel the need for spiritual guidance and comfort as I face the day's struggles. So I was wondering if I could strip down, smear myself with paste, and set fire to this little effigy of you in a non-denominational sort of way. So then there's a picture of Calvin outside the principal's office saying, boy, what a touchy shut subject. Anyway, it's got nothing to do with anything. Okay, mental behaviour. It's covered as violent and pernicious view. I'm just skipping through these. I want to just quickly look at the sutta on that. Let me just come out of that and look at the sutta. So there you go. Okay, so this is one of the suttas that we had to look at, and this is the Salayaka Sutta, and this gives the 10 kusala kamapata, the ways of wholesome action, in some detail. And so this teaching, the dasa kusala kamapata, the 10 ways of wholesome action, okay, is a very, very basic teaching, very important teaching in ethics, in Buddhism, because it sort of takes the list of the 5 precepts and it extends it somewhat to make it, to give it a bit more of a dimension so that it includes the mind as well. And I'm just going to very briefly look at a few things here before we go for our first break, okay? It covers the same ground that we've already looked at, but let's just have a look at exactly what the suttas say. So 3 kinds of bodily conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct. There are 4, what are the 3 kinds? Someone kills living beings. He is murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. He takes what is not given. He takes by way of theft the wealth and property of others in the village or forest. He misconducts himself in sensual pleasures. He has intercourse with women who are protected by their mother, father, brother, sisters or relatives who have a husband who are protected by law, and even those who are garlanded in token of betrothal. So what that last phrase means is basically like somebody who you've proposed to, and they've got maybe like an engagement ring or something like that, and so they've got some kind of sign that they're betrothed, even if they might not be married. So you can see here that the idea is about having intercourse with somebody in a way of breaking some kind of social contract or bond. Verbal conduct, speaking falsehood. When summoned to a court or to a meeting or to his relative's presence or his guild or royal family's presence and questioned as a witness thus, so good man, tell us what you know. Not knowing, he says, I know, or knowing, he says, I do not know. Not seeing, he says, I see, or seeing, he says, I do not see. In full awareness, he speaks falsehood for his own ends or for another's ends or for some trifling worldly end. Now, this is a very interesting description of that idea of wrong speech, because you can see what's meant here is obviously quite a serious wrong speech. I mean, what's described there is actually not just breaking a precept, it's actually breaking the law, right? And so that thing that he's speaking in full awareness with sampajanya. In the Vinaya, it talks about this and it says what that means is that you know beforehand, I will lie. You know why you're doing it. I am lying, and you know afterwards I did lie. Okay, so you have like a clear awareness through the whole process. So again, you know, there's these shades of grey around it. So people often think about white lies and things like that. Well, obviously that's a lot less harmful. So it's giving an example here of a kind of lie which is extremely harmful and which definitely should be avoided at all costs. And then there are other ones which, yes, it's probably not a good idea to do, but maybe it's not going to be so harmful. So. I'm actually going to skip ahead to go to the positive side because I prefer reading the positive side. It's more fun. Abstaining from killing living beings, he abides compassionate for all living beings. And so this description of the sila is much better than just the precepts because it's giving you something to aspire to. Abandoning malicious speech, he does not repeat elsewhere what he's heard here in order to divide those people from these. He is one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendships, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. He abandons harsh speech, speaking such words as are gentle, pleasing to the ear and lovable as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many and agreeable to many. he speaks at the right time. What is fact, what is good on the Dhamma and Vinaya, such words as are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. Okay, so this is a lovely description of right speech. And again, what's really being emphasized here, it's not just refraining from lying, but it's using your speech in a positive and constructive way in accordance with the Dhamma. And then three kinds of mental conduct, and this is the one that I actually just wanted to look at here. So the three kinds of mental conduct, basically it has covetousness, aversion, and wrong views, right? So these are forms of those basic defilements that we saw earlier. Remember in the Kusala Sutta we looked at earlier, it said if you had lust, hatred, and delusion, then it prompts you to do these bad acts, right? So here in the Dasa Kusala Kamapata, it has these three same things. Except it makes it clear here that what's meant is basically strong forms of these things, okay? So the word here is abhijja, right? Rather than some of the more words that are used, more commonly words used for desire, here is abhijja, and it clearly means to covet, right? So here, somebody is not covetous. He doesn't covet the wealth and property of others thus, oh, may what belongs to another be mine, okay? And so this is obviously something which is very kind of common, it's very normal, isn't it? We walk down the street and you see a nice car or someone wearing nice clothes or something like that, and you covet them. Oh, I want to get that. Oh, I hope I can get it. And so it's kind of a strong form of desire. So this is that one. And the same thing, being without ill will. So it's not saying that you're going to break your precepts because you have an isolated thought of anger or something like that, but he has intentions free of hate, things like, may these beings be free from enmity, affliction, and anxiety, may they live happily. So you have that good intention. And then the opposite, of course, you break your precepts because may these beings be hurt and may they be harmed and so on. He has right view, undistorted vision. So here, right view is a strong form, or having the wrong view is a strong form of delusion, and having the right view is a strong form of wisdom. He has right view, undistorted vision, thus there is what is given and what is offered, what is sacrificed, and so on and so forth. So this is the basic definition of right view in terms of understanding karma and the results of karma. So these are the three aspects of right mental conduct, okay? So these are this Dasa Kusala Kamapata, the ways of wholesome action, is describing something which gives you the bodily and the verbal conduct, but also the mental conduct, which is all a part of good sila, or good ethics. Okay. We are now running out of time, so we should have a break. I will come back at 9 o'clock and I will give you an insoluble ethical dilemma and you will have to solve it, okay? And I haven't decided what insoluble ethical dilemma to give you, so if you have one, then you can come up and suggest it, okay?